blessing, Father, and I ask you to use me right now as you make you with peace. And bring life here that's growing bigger and brighter according to your will. In your Son, Yeshua, by your Spirit and your Word, in Yeshua's name. And I'd like to thank my wife for leading worship in our congregation. How long has it been? I've met a lot of people that desperately want to lead worship in the course of the last 28 years or so. I'm not sure if those people think it's easy or not. But I know that to lead worship sometimes requires a person to just set everything aside, no matter what it is. And worship God and lead others into it at the same time. And that may just sound like practically the right thing to do, but it's another thing to actually just do that. And she also lived through leading worship with me up there with her. And that was actually for quite a while. And I don't know, I thought of it as one of the tricks God played on me over the course of my life, that I would ever even be involved in leading worship or whatever you want to call what I used to do. I'm not sure. I guess it taught me some things. And I remember Jackie saying that I couldn't keep doing that after they left because it was too much. I don't know if it was too much. Yeah. Anyway, thank you, Jim, for all you've done, for being so faithful and for Maybe you haven't any thoughts right at the moment, by the way. You don't have to answer out loud, but you know, what kind of thoughts are you having? You can answer in your own head. Or you can ask God if you're not sure. People aren't always sure. Or if you're sure, ask God too, because a lot of times when people are sure, they're not right. So, have you ever been wrong about even what you were thinking? And you weren't even thinking what you thought you were thinking. What about how you're feeling? Do you ever not feel the way you think you're feeling? I see some faces out there. Is it possible to actually think you're feeling a certain way and be feeling a very different way than what you're thinking you're feeling? That can be, sounds like it can be tricky. So let me see. Where should I start here? I may just go to Psalm 139. I was about to say my marker here is not where Psalm 139 is, but it actually is. We all think the things that we should be thinking, right? I mean, we think the way God thinks. I mean, not exactly, but we're always just adjusting all of our thoughts to match what God would think, right? And what He would want us to think, and what He would want us to believe, right? Isn't that what we do all the time?
If only.
And by now, for at least over half of us, it's gotten really easy to do that, right? I mean, it's automatic because we're trained to trust God, to believe Him, to tell ourselves back what He has said to us, and those thoughts they've actually become our thoughts, right? I mean, they've replaced whatever we used to think before we met the Lord, right? Some degree. I'll read just the last two verses of Psalm 139. I should probably read the whole thing, but I mean, you do all know that you're fearfully and wonderfully made, right? That you're made wonderfully. You're a wonder. You know that, right? In some ways, I feel like I've gotten obsessed with what I think, what people think, and with what thinking is, and what the problem with thinking is, and what to do about it. And I guess maybe that's a problem. It could be that even my thinking about the thinking and what to do about thinking is wrong thinking. And it can just get really disturbing. But then where does disturbance come from? I mean, feelings just happen, right? I mean, feelings just happen, right? They just come from no place, right?
Wrong.
Did someone say wrong?
I said wrong.
What?
I said wrong.
Well, yell on me.
Thank you.
Well, okay, so feelings don't just happen? I mean, you know, there's a common phrase in English that certain things just happen. We should all trust God completely with everything all the time, shouldn't we?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And can that get silly? Like, what if I told you I was going to stop drinking water because I realized I should just have faith in God to hydrate me?
That's not trust and faith in God.
Well, that's not trust.
No.
Oh. What if my engine blows up in my vehicle because it has no oil, because I haven't checked it for 2.5 years, and then I declare that I'm under attack from the enemy because I'm doing God's work? Maybe what do you think of that?
You were doing God's work, you would have checked your oil.
What?
If you were doing God's work, you would have checked your oil.
I know someone whose oil light came on. Instead of stopping, they decided to drive from there to their mechanic. And on the way there, the engine seized up, and that was the end of it. And as I remember, I think that person's response to the whole thing was pretty much that they were under spiritual attack. And you know what? They were, but it didn't have anything to do with that. That was because of inattention. And inattention is a subject I know something about. you know, I mean, one of my favorite things I have detailed to me is a diagnosis that actually includes the words primarily inattentive. The, you know, I wear it with pride. I'm primarily inattentive. I almost was run over by a train because I wasn't paying attention. What do you have to complain? I was so focused on not being focused on the world that I was living in that though my ears were fine, my eyes were fine, and my tactile sensation was all completely intact, I was able to do something I defy any of you to do, which is to sit there straddling a rail, go right under my belly button, while a train approached without hearing it, feeling it, or seeing it. And I've been on railroad tracks, and I know that you can feel the train from a long ways away, even if you're not there. Even if you can't hear, you can tell it's coming. But I was able to be oblivious. So, you know, look, we all have some things we can brag about. And I am very proud of that. It's, I mean, you know, you're just, some things you're just born with and then you refine them. And by the age of 6 or 7, I was pretty good at it. I could think about what I wanted to think about to the point where I could not hear my mother's voice. Well, I do remember some times where it was like, I could. It was like I was in another world. I was sort of conscious of it, but I still wouldn't respond. And it wasn't like, I didn't exactly choose not to respond. It just couldn't cause whatever it takes to respond to happen. And I could almost think about it and wonder about it, but it's like it was just kind of weird. I'm very proud of that one as well. Anyway, you know, the train very nearly cut me in half. I don't think I had a half a second left. And I'm very proud of that, and I defy any of you to pull that off the way that I did that day.
Yeah.
Who has train tracks?
And so, I also have another thing, along with primarily inattentive, they call it hyperfocus, which is, it's ironic. Hyperfocus, primarily inattentive. Like, really, really focused and inattentive at the same time. Try to pull that off. I am fearfully and wonderfully made. And I want you to feel the way I feel about yourself. I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. It seems that God knew I was going to be like that and didn't do anything to stop it. I don't know if he literally caused it, but he seems to have wanted me to be that way. But I've spent a lot of time in my life not being so happy about things about the way that I am. But I just realized today just how proud I am of being primarily inattentive and hyper-focusing at the same time. I mean, I'm learning to embrace it. And I'm also trying to learn how to keep that from dragging other people out of their fault. It may be something that has driven you partly out of your skull. You didn't know that that's what it was about me at that moment. But it was doing it. I don't know. But there's all kinds of other stuff. So anyway, seriously, you should be able to embrace you without just, you know, saying that, well, this is the way I am, so everybody should get over it and excuse. You know, that's not a tribute. But the thing is, we are in these bodies with brains that we have, and we should be able to be okay with that, because God made us the way that He made us for His reasons. We may not even ever know exactly what His reasons were for some of that, but we don't really have to know. But you remember when God says to Moses, well, who made man's mouth dumb or his ears deaf? Or how does the whole thing go? In response to Moses' objections, basically he's saying, look, I don't know if he's... There's some arguing about whether Moses really couldn't talk or not. You know? But he saw himself that way, he claimed it. But God's like, well, what's the difference? It's me that makes people seeing or unseen, or able to talk, not able to talk, deaf or hearing. And it's me that can say to that person, go to this place and do such and such a thing, and it can happen because of me, regardless of whether they are the way they describe themselves or not, because God performs His will, and He uses people that can't perform His will to perform His will. And so inability is the qualification, right? Does God call people to do things that they're able to do themselves? Like, you mean without His help? Is that what He does? What do you think? Nobody has an answer.
Say the question again, please.
Did I zone out?
No.
Oh, you? Oh. What do you think? And what is being asked in the psalm?
Speak the truth in love.
Hmm?
It's the person asking God to speak the truth in love.
So, have you ever done this? Have you ever prayed this? It's a good thing to pray. I think it's better to pray it out, you know, observing like the whole psalm. And even better, the more things you have in mind about what God said about you and in the scriptures, throughout the scriptures. In the book of Hebrews, it says here in the 4th chapter, for the word of God is living and active, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing to the division of soul and spirit, of joints and marrow, and discerning the thoughts and intentions of the heart. And no creature is hidden from his sight, but all are naked and exposed to the eye of him to whom we must give account. Is that frightening or comforting? How does it strike you?
Both.
Is it ever just comforting? I'm glad that no creature is hidden from his sight. So that means me. I'm a creature. Right? He can see me. No matter where I am, he can see me. No matter what I pull up over my head, he can see me. If I cover my eyes and go, you can't see me, you can still see me. And of course, if we're adults, when we do that, it's much more sophisticated. It doesn't look so silly as a little kid. Refine enough so that we don't think we look ridiculous when we're doing it, right? You don't have to answer it. So no creature is hidden from his sight. He can see me. All are naked and exposed. Oh, naked and exposed. I like that. It makes me feel good. I mean, I've been naked and exposed to him for almost 60 years now. I have gotten much more used to it than maybe I was when I was 11 or 12. I'm naked and exposed. I mean, I'm completely uncovered. You can see everything. There's nothing that's hidden from him to whom I must give an account. And his word, it's living, and it's active, and it's sharper than any two-edged sword. And some of them are really sharp. Really, really sharp. And so they can divide between this and that. They can, piercing to the division of soul and spirit, joints and marrow, and discerning the thoughts and intentions of the heart. So there's nothing that is not sharp enough to easily find its way through, and it can discern the thoughts and the intentions of the heart. Can you discern the thoughts and intentions of your own heart? What?
Sometimes.
Okay. It might be both. It might be a mixture of both. I'm not sure how totally we can ever. I mean, the thing is, the thoughts and intentions of the heart could mean, we could think of it as particular thoughts and intentions about a particular thing at a certain moment. And it's possible we could have some understanding about that. But it's talking about all of them, right? It's talking about the whole thing. So do any of us think that we actually can discern and understand all of our thoughts and all of our intentions and motives all at the same time? But we may actually understand some of it part of the time, right? And the Lord sometimes shows us, like, I mean, I've had it happen where it's like, he just, like, goes, that one. And I'm going, oh, yeah, I remember I asked you to do that Psalm 139 thing one time. I guess maybe you're still doing it. But, you know, I didn't necessarily ask her to show me that one. And some of those times, it's pretty clear to me he's discerned the thoughts and the intentions of my heart and showed me part of it. So the part that he showed me, in a moment like that, I'm reasonably sure I'm discerning along with him what it is he's trying to show me at the moment. But that doesn't mean that I think I understand it as well as he does, or as fully as he does. But he can reveal things to us about it. So, is that scary? I find most of this to be unbelievably comforting. See, because God, he knows more about me than I do. He knows my thoughts, my intentions, my motivations better than I do. He shows me ones that I'm not very happy to find out that I have now and then. But he loves me so absolutely, completely, fully, and totally, and has redeemed me 100%, if it's possible that there could be more than 100%, that goes beyond that, but I guess we understand 100% to be all of this, right? So he's completely redeemed me, he loves me, he washed me clean. I didn't deserve it. He loved me. He set out to do this when I was still his enemy, when I had no interest in him, when I didn't want to be his friend. He chose me. He loved me first. He's done all of these things. And so I actually think that it's far more comforting when you understand what God did, why he did it, and on what basis. It's far more comforting than disturbing, even if sometimes it might be disturbing, because I didn't have to produce anything personally or have any merit of my own that I could claim as a reason why I, of all people, should be loved by him and redeemed by him, right? It's his choice, his love. He made me. He made me the way he chose to make me. He redeemed me at the moment that he chose to redeem me. He washed me in the blood of his son, who was perfect, who has all merit, that can claim everything. And I can't claim any of the stuff that Yeshua can claim. Well, I can claim to be human. Because, well, because God made me that way. And Yeshua came as a man. So the thing is, it's not based on, I don't have to find it in me, because I know it's God's volition and God's will and God's love. So I don't have to find anything about me on which to base my security, except what God has done. And he made me a human being, so I can't take any credit for that. So within his all-encompassing will and understanding, I don't actually have cause to be frightened of him. Right? I'm not saying that I couldn't be frightened of him at a given moment, but the thing is, he hasn't come to condemn me. he hasn't come to kick me around. I might be afraid of what he wants me to do because I'm looking at me and not at him. And see, that's when I'm looking at me, that's above me. And that's when I'm wishing that I could do it, that I could know I had it in the bag myself, whatever it is he wants me to do. And by the way, I don't have very often the sense that I have it in the bag myself. I'm not saying I never have. I think I've been quite presumptuous on a number of occasions. But I don't naturally just wake up in the morning thinking that I can just do it. That isn't my primary problem. I can be that in some ways. But either way, whether you're overconfident about yourself or whether you're totally underconfident about yourself, it basically ends up to be about the same thing, because overconfidence in yourself, that's the thing that doesn't trust God, and underconfidence in yourself doesn't trust God either. See, my reason for doing it, if I'm overconfident, is because I can handle it. And I can do it, and I don't really need God, even though I might claim that I do. If I'm underconfident, my reason for not doing it is because of the way I am, and that's, am I making sense? And I'm not going to trust God because I don't have it in myself. So, see, then, that's all about me. If I can, I can do it myself. If I can't, I can't do it myself. And in both of those cases, there's not really a lot of room for him to do what he wants to do. Unless I accept what he wants to do, and that he'll give me what I need. And that frequently he'll give me what I need. So late that I could completely freak out by the time the moment comes. Because he doesn't stick it in my pocket or in my holster or in whatever it is so that I can go, okay, thank you. I've got everything. I don't have to worry at all. I'm not saying I ever have to worry. But it's funny. He wants us to trust him. Isn't that funny? Okay. So, the older I get, the more I find comfort in verses that could be really disturbing. But I'm not claiming that God can't be disturbing. I mean, there is no more disturbing being than God, but there is no more comforting being than God. You know, it was grace that taught my heart to fear. And grace my fears relieved. And after the heart comes to fear and the grace does what it does and relieves the fears of things, I don't think there's any need to spend most of our life in the fear part. Not when it comes to God. So what do you think about God, and what do you think about you, and how do the two mix together? I'm going to ask you what you think of this. Did we decide, do feelings just happen? They don't just happen? Where do they come from? Does a stork bring them? Mm-hmm. Just to ask you what you think about this. Do you think it could be that your mood is caused by what you think?
In part.
So the way you feel could be caused by what you think?
Mm-hmm.
Both of what?
Doing, thinking, and feeling all
influence each other.
They do, don't they? So, what do you think happens the moment you have a thought and you believe the thought? And Anybody here ever had a thought and believed it? Really? And I like that thing that don't believe everything you think. It's Mumper Sticker, I guess. Don't believe everything you think. So the moment you have a thought and you believe it, do you think the moment you have a thought and you believe the thought that there's an emotional response to the thought? So the feeling that comes in has it's connected to the thinking? Yeah, well, believing it, is believing an action? Oh, believing is an action. Okay, so if you feel depressed, for instance, anybody ever feel depressed? Really? Even as a believer? So if you feel depressed, does negativity tend to go along with feeling depressed? So, do you have to practice being negative? Does it need to be refined? Like, do you have to work at it?
Some people seem to think so about what they do.
What?
I said some people seem to think so about what they do.
Yeah, it could be. So, if you're in a state of depression, do you think that that your thoughts tend to be pervasively negative?
Dior.
Yes.
Hey, what is the deal with that guy? Okay, so if you're in a state of depression, it's likely then that there's a pervasive negativity that comes along with it. And is it likely that you could come to believe that things are actually as bad as they're seeming to you when you're in a state like that?
Yes.
And I don't know, how likely do you think it is that things are as bad as they seem?
Not usually.
Okay. So, do you think negative thoughts can create emotional turmoil?
Yes.
And now this part's getting harder. If you have negative thoughts and they're causing emotional turmoil, is it possible that almost all the time those thoughts contain gross distortions of the way things really are, or of the truth?
Yes.
What do you think? What is a gross distortion of the way things really are, or the truth? What do you think?
It's a lie.
If it's a lie. And then, I hesitate to speak like this, but could it be that the thinking that you or I are having at those times is wrong? Well, if it's wrong, I'm trying to be really gentle. Change it? You think?
Yeah.
I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. Because that could contain more gross discouragement. So, okay, so then the distortions when we're like that, then the distortions look like they're actually valid to us, like they make sense, right? So it sounds then, based on what we've talked about so far, that probably those thoughts and perceptions are irrational. Maybe just plain wrong. What do you think?
I don't think they need to be irrational to be wrong.
They don't have to be irrational, but a lot of times they actually are irrational.
And a lot of times they're very irrational.
Sometimes they are. Yeah. It's not always exactly the same. So, so if these things are basically true a lot of the time, do you think that they actually cause a lot of suffering for us, for the person that's in that state? And is that what we should be aiming for? Suffering? Just to suffer? All of a sudden that button that hurts, it just popped back in my head.
Stop! Stop it!
We should all watch it together sometime. Okay, this is where the I've been thinking a lot about lost people. And what do lost people need? I mean, they need the truth, right? They need light instead of darkness. They need love instead of the counterfeits of love they've experienced. They need the truth in place of lies, right? And, you know, I think about myself encountering lost people and also believing people, because the effects can be very similar. And the state I'm in has a lot to do with what I'm able to convey to them, right? And if, I mean, I could say the right things, but if I'm not exactly believing the right things or feeling the feelings are determinate. But how many of us have told people the truth, you know, the right answer, at the same moment we're not accepting the same answer? How many of us have done that? I dare imagine we've probably all done it, and maybe quite a few times. But, like, does that sound like really powerful to proclaim something like that to someone when you're actually not accepting it yourself in your own situation?
No.
It sounds like one of those words that I really hate. I don't even want to say it because I don't want to be a surrogate. Hypocrisy. Right? But do we all care about people that don't know the Lord? Do everybody care about them? Some of us do, that's good. Lord, fill us with your love. That's my thought, you know. I mean, it could be a cognitive dispersion. And so I don't really want to know, but please, I know you're not done with me yet. last week I thought that was the last painful truth about me. There's one left? Alright, I'm bracing myself, but it's going to be all over. I'm just gonna try to bring up a few thoughts in front of you in the next few minutes, and hopefully they'll all connect. In 2 Corinthians, I'm sure there's something from the fourth chapter that I want for this, but I don't know what it is at the moment. So, chapter 8. As it is written, you gathered much, had no excess, and he who gathered little had no shortfall. You know what that's from?
From the earthquake.
What do you think when you think of that? You imagine two people? You imagine groups, but it's like two people. One of them goes up and gathers banana, right?
And you just gather piles and piles and piles of,
right? And why might they do that? They're really hungry. They're worried about not having enough to eat, right? Probably. And the other one, some gathered a little. And I'm not sure what they were thinking. They were really stupid. But so in both cases, no matter what they were thinking, in both cases.
Maybe it was their ability, not their thoughts.
Could be. But in both cases, each party had plenty, right? Nobody was without, and nobody had too much. And then there were the ones that I couldn't even talk about now, but there were the ones that tried to save some, and that's another thing. But the thing is, no matter how they gathered, everybody had plenty. And that isn't the way things normally seem to work in our just regular sphere of life on Earth, right? I mean, that doesn't seem like people have gathered more. Sometimes they have more. So what are we supposed to think? I mean, is this just a description of what happened there, or is there something more in it? Well, later on in the ninth chapter it says, consider this, whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. And whoever sows generously will also reap generously. It kind of goes along with the gathering thing, doesn't it?
The gathering is a coordinate.
What?
The gathering is coordinate.
Yeah. But nobody had too little and nobody had too much, no matter what they gathered. So apparently the size of the eyes wasn't the point, right? Or the perception of need didn't determine what the need was. I imagine the one that gathered a lot could look at the one that gathered a little and think that it couldn't be enough. But everybody had enough and nobody had too much. So God's economy is like it's different than ours, it seems, isn't it? And so he says, each one should give what he has decided in his heart to give, not out of regret or compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that in all things, at all times, having all that you need, you will abound in every good work. As it is written, he scattered abroad his gifts to the poor, his righteousness endures forever. So I've been thinking about this. You ever have a sense that there are people in need and you feel some burden, like maybe you should go and do something? You might know what the thing is, but you also feel empty and tired. And then you look at them, it may not even be the multitudes, it might be one or two, and they might look like a multitude to you in your emotional state, and we could determine how much we have by what we think we managed to gather, or what we think we just don't have at all. But how should we decide what to do, what we have enough energy for, what there's enough power for, what's even right? Should we determine it based on how tired we are, how strapped we feel, how much we think we lack? What should we determine? Is this true about you? And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that in all things. How many are left out of that? It almost sounds like all things, all times, all ways. Would you agree with me on that? In all things, Oh, it does say at all times. Sorry, I didn't even get to. So that in all things, at all times, having all that you need, you, having all that you need, you will abound in every good work. What does that sound like? But I'm mostly thinking of the sense of need that's out somewhere and the way we perceive for self with reference to the need. And how easy it is to just think we need to conserve or just think we just don't have it. And I'm pretty sure a lot of times when one decides not to act, that's not the moment that there's a big supply of what they needed, because if you don't do it, you don't need it. And the conclusion that it wasn't there, then might be wrong, because if you move, like God says, stop the act and step forward. And Moses steps forward, and then everything starts to happen. But God doesn't do it while your feet are still from the plant of where they were to begin with, usually. I've always wished he would. I'd like to move after he's already doing it. He doesn't generally do it that way.
We're always moving after he's already done it.
Well, yeah. We can't really get ahead of him. So, there's a verse that says, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. You think that's true? If I visualize myself as paralyzed, do you think I can succeed in becoming paralyzed?
Yeah. Absolutely.
I can think of myself as unable. I can't do that. I can't move. I can't even get up and go over there. I could end up not getting up. I could end up not going over there. I could end up in any practical sense, as far as what it looks like, unable. I could do that to me. And with a little help from the enemy. By the way, the liar and the murderer, and have been from the beginning. He's the father of lies. He's really, really cunning, at least in comparison to human beings. We've been studying now for thousands of years. He knows so much about how we tick. He's good at messing with us. And so I asked you a couple of weeks ago to take that passage from Philippians 4. And it says, rejoice in the Lord always, and again I will say rejoice. Let your reasonableness be known to everyone. The Lord is at hand. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer. prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in the sight of God. And it says, finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. What you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. I just ask everybody if they would just pray and just actually practice that. So you start with what? Rejoice all the time. We all do that all the time, right? You're good. Okay. Rejoice in the Lord always. And I'll say it again. Rejoice. If it's painful to hear that, and I know what that feels like, by the way, God's trying to tell you something. And He is also asking you to rejoice.
Say it again, Mr. Lunger.
What?
Say it again, Mr. Lunger.
Rejoice. Rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I will say rejoice. So, don't be anxious. But when anxiousness comes, take all of it and pray. Bring your prayers and your supplications with thanksgiving. Let God know what your requests are. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in the sight of Yeshua. And then the dwelling on what's honorable, lovely, true, and all that. You know, do you suppose that includes like you're a child of God, you know, you've been washed in the blood of Yeshua, that you're clean, that you're a new creation, that you have the mind of Messiah, that you can actually learn to flow with that mind, that you can do all things through Him who strengthens you, that He will cause an abundance of every last thing that you need to flow beyond what we can ask or think. And that these are the kind of thoughts that we need to have. We need to practice those thoughts. And when the thoughts that we have don't match those things, we need to actually actively ask God to remove them and help us remove them, help us rebuke them, help us think the true things that He's told us about ourselves. He'll give us grace to do it. We can't actually just transform our minds on our own, but He does it. And a new, you know what? A new creation has new thoughts. A new creation doesn't think the way the old creation does. And there are so many lies and half-truths that we easily just flow in without even thinking. There are all kinds of Christian memes, for instance, that say patently unbiblical things, including about prayer. I just saw one. I didn't get anything I asked for, but I got everything that I need. Well, the everything I need part, I can kind of, you know, like, well, God gives us beyond what we can ask or think. So, memes on the same site, by the way, say things that are absolutely opposed to that meme. It drives me nuts. But the thing is, God doesn't just only supply just as much as we, just what we have to get by. That's not the scripture. That's not what the scriptures say about Him. And it says He gives good gifts to His children. They ask for a fish. He doesn't give them a poisonous snake. He doesn't toss a cobra at them when they want a fish. And He doesn't toss a rock at them when they say, you know, I need a loaf of bread. He gives good gifts. You know how easy it is to think He's a stingy jerk that just likes to make people suffer? that will just let us suffer our miserable way through this life until finally we die and apparently we get to go to someplace better? That's not who he is! Because that's who he was. I don't know if it would make that much sense to rejoice, and again I say rejoice. Rejoice. You know why it says rejoice? God's not stupid. He's given us reason to rejoice. He actually wants us to experience what he's done for us. To live like we're living in. Because we are and we should be. So, it's hard. But if we decide to replace the lies and the wrong thoughts, the false things and the twisted perceptions with the truth, it can only, well, be very good for us personally, but make us more effective and make us more observant to all the blessings that God is always pouring out, but sometimes they seem to run off of us as though we're holding an umbrella to try to prevent them from getting to us. And he wants to bless. He comes to bless. Will there be trouble? Yes. But there's more than enough grace for that. You can ask Clark about what sufficiency is all about. In mathematics, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's great. Because sufficiency doesn't, it's not the way it sounded to me. It's like, see, when I read it, I know it can't mean what it sounds like to me, but my grace is sufficient for you. You could read that as though, well, it's just enough to squeak by. That's not what it is at all. We have everything at our disposal. So, Lord, I ask you to just begin to speak to us. I ask you to help us all really have a transformation of mind, transformation of thoughts, that those things that are hurtful to us come in and look at them with us and show us what's hurtful. And the freedom and joy would increase and life would increase because we've gone with you and listened to you and accepted the things you've shown us. Just bring about good, bring encouragement and hope.